Guitarathon. There's a Fender American-made Strattor P-Bass. Your choice, just $6.99. Plus 70,000 amazing guitars priced under $200. Guitarathon's going down now through Sunday at Guitar City. Special 18-month financing available.
KKMC Gonzalez.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, I'd love to hear from you today. We can talk about your questions. If you have another viewpoint from that of the host and would like to give that some kind of balanced treatment, feel free to give me a call. We can talk about that as well. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program today, we have a line open for you right now. Now, I don't know if any of you listening to this program are going to be in Southern California this weekend. I know that right now our afternoon program doesn't actually air in Southern California. We have a morning program in Southern California, but nonetheless, people from all over come to Southern California for various reasons. And if you're going to be in Southern Cal this weekend and would like to join us, we have a meeting in Temecula, my hometown. It's an open Bible discussion. There's a potluck beforehand, and you can come to that if you want to or just to the meeting. That's in Temecula, and the times and address and all that stuff and a map can be found at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. I'll probably, in addition to just having a time of Bible Q&A, also share something of my reflections on the election and its ramifications for Christians in this country. But that will only be a short portion of our evening. That'll be brief, but I do plan to just have a regular open Bible discussion the most of the evening. So if you're going to be in Southern California, would like to join us, that's this Saturday night, day after tomorrow, and welcome you to come on down. Go to the website, thenarrowpath.com, check the link that says announcements, and then come on down. We'll be glad to talk to you and meet you. Mike from Las Vegas is our first caller today. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello again, Steve. Nice talking to you.
Yeah.
Hey, I have two questions about the same verse, and it's Revelation chapter 14, and they're verses 9 to 11.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that maybe those three verses are out of order. Maybe they should be in Revelation chapter 20, but maybe that's how the vision came about, that it was back and forth, back and forth. My other question about the same three verses is, I'm far from convinced about eternal punishment, but these three verses, especially verse 11, seem to insinuate eternal punishment. Do you have any insight on that?
Maybe. I've mentioned many times there's about five verses, maybe six in the Bible, that seem to suggest eternal torment. I believe there's a much larger number that would seem to rule that out. But five or six is something that has to be considered. And of those, three of them are in the book of Revelation. This is the main one I mean, there are a couple of them in Revelation 19 and 20 also. But in my opinion, at least in all the years that I taught fairly confidently the traditional view of hell, this verse that you brought up, I always thought was one of the strongest. And I'll read the whole section for those who don't have their Bibles open, which would be most of our listeners right now. It says, "Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast and his image, and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. And they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name.'" Now, first of all, one question has to be asked. Is this talking about punishment after death? You're right. It doesn't appear, as we might expect, in chapter 20, where we find the last judgment and such and people thrown into the lake of fire. This is actually six chapters early for that. In a section that is talking about judgments that take place on earth, we have to at least consider the possibility, as one possibility, that this is talking about an earthly judgment. Although, if it is, of course, we'd have to assume there's some symbolic language. Well, lo and behold, when we look at the passage, there is symbolic language. For example, it talks about people drinking of the wine of the wrath of God. Now, God's wrath isn't literal wine. It says, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. This cup is not literal either. In fact, back in Psalm 78 and in Jeremiah 25, this idea of a cup filled with the wrath of God is actually found a number of places in the Old Testament. It's a figure of speech, of course. God doesn't have a literal cup, and his wrath is not literal wine. But his judgment upon Babylon, his judgment upon nations that suffer his wrath in the Old Testament, and I would especially commend to you Jeremiah 25, which mentions Jeremiah being sent by God around to all these different nations and making them drink of a wine cup and telling them that they will, in fact, drink of the wine cup of the wrath of God, and referring to the fact that they will suffer conquest by the Babylonians or by some other force. And in other words, drinking of the wine of the wrath of God, at least in the Old Testament, doesn't refer to something that happens after people die, but speaks of the judgment upon a nation, different nations in different cases, but it's national judgment. That is generally what is referred to here. Now, there's many different opinions about Revelation, of course, and one would have to take with some humility any suggestion by anybody, including myself, as, you know, is this possibly it? My own belief about Revelation 14 is that the main thrust of the prophecy is about the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. And it's not surprising to find the language, the symbolic language of judgment that we find in the Old Testament, which in the Old Testament is applied to earthly judgments of nations. And so we have in verse 10 this symbolic description of drinking the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured up into the cup of his indignation. And then we have another image from the Old Testament. It says, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone. And then it says, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. Now, the fire and brimstone, of course, we associate it with hell, largely because of this passage. But we have to recognize that this passage is actually borrowing language from Isaiah 34. In Isaiah 34, it's talking about the destruction of the nation of Edom. And it talks about the rivers of flaming pitch replacing rivers of water in that place, and there's smoke ascending forever, and this kind of thing. This is talking about the earthly judgment upon Edom in Isaiah 34. Now, this passage in Revelation is not talking about Edom, but it's using the same language. And we might suspect that it might use the same language the same way. This smoke arising forever from Edom and all that, it is not talking about hell. It's talking about the judgment of Edom when the nation fell to invaders. It was the Babylonians that conquered Edom, and then the Nabataeans took it over, and the Edomites eventually became extinct. But the point is, Isaiah 34 itself, in talking about the fall of Edom, is borrowing earlier imagery from Sodom and Gomorrah. In Genesis, of course, chapter 19, God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And you might remember that he did it with fire and brimstone. That's sulfur. Fire and brimstone from heaven came down and destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And it says the next day, of course, after the city was burned up and everyone was gone and dead, it says Abraham went out and looked in the direction of Sodom, and lo, the city, the smoke of the city ascended like that of a great furnace. Now here the burning was essentially done. Everything was just smoldering now, and there is smoke ascending, like the smoke of a furnace. Now, the imagery of a nation being destroyed with fire and brimstone and having its smoke ascending as a memorial to the fact that it's been destroyed comes first in the literal description of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It then is found in the poetic language of Isaiah applied to Edom, and, arguably, it's applied in Revelation 14 to the destruction of Jerusalem, following the tradition of Isaiah in borrowing the language from Genesis. So, in other words, we have in Revelation, here and elsewhere, of course, a great deal of Old Testament imagery. Most Christians are unfamiliar with the Old Testament and very unfamiliar with the way that the Old Testament imagery is used in the New Testament. Therefore, when people read the book of Revelation, they sometimes know no better than to just take it literally when the original readers would recognize this is a rebirth of the images of Old Testament judgments. This is not literal. I mean, it could be literal, but there's no reason to take it literally. And it is hard to take it literally here because it says in verse 10, these will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Now, the torment of sinners in the lake of fire can hardly be said to be taking place in the presence of God. As a matter of fact, most people who teach the traditional doctrine of hell insist, based on 2 Thessalonians 1:9, that hell consists of being eternally banished from the presence of God. And so you can't really have it both ways. You can't have an eternal banishment from the presence of God and an eternal torment in the presence of God. This would be, of course, contradictory terms. And Revelation, of course, is that book more than any other that's given over to symbolism. So I'm of the opinion that this is probably not talking about hell at all. And the idea of the smoke ascending forever and ever, it doesn't say they're tormented forever and ever. It says the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. That is, again, as in the case of Sodom, when Sodom had been burned up, when the people had been tormented and killed and burned up, the next day the smoke was still ascending as a memorial that the judgment had taken place. And so this imagery is, well, the memorial of the destruction of this society that is being described here is a continual memorial. It's as if the smoke from the burning ascends perpetually. And, you know, for those who feel like taking Revelation literally is really the safest or the most faithful way to understand it, I won't try to convince you otherwise. But for those who actually recognize that Revelation is full of imagery, rebirthed from the Old Testament, and full of symbolism, I would simply point out that these symbols here are used probably in the same way that the same symbols are used in many passages in the Old Testament, which would mean it's not a description of post-mortem judgment, but it's a description of a destruction of some society. Some would say maybe the whole earth society. Others might say Jerusalem. The same language is used for the destruction of Edom, a single society, in Isaiah 34. So those would be my thoughts on that.
Steve, you've given me a new train of thought to go on here. I thank you for that, and may our great King bless you and your family. Steve, we'll talk to you next time, buddy.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate your calls. Bye now. Okay, Jim from Portland, Oregon is next. Jim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I've been listening for a while. I'm interested about the theme music. What is there a label on that of some kind? I really like that.
I like it too.
I had another question also.
Sure. You know, it's interesting that theme music was written and performed by a friend of mine. It is, to my knowledge, not recorded on a CD, although he did later go on and record lots of his music on CDs. This particular song that's our theme music, he recorded on a cassette tape, I think before there were CDs, and he told me that the song, which has words, I mean, this, when you hear our theme music, it's really just the introduction to a song that eventually has words. And he said that the song was inspired by by one of the messages I've preached. He was a student in our school in Oregon. Last I heard, he's a music pastor, worship pastor at Calvary Chapel in McMinnville, Oregon. His name's John Marr. He's a very good songwriter and performer, and a godly man and Christian leader. And he was a student at one time in our school. And he listened to my lecture series, or my lecture on what's called A Vision for Children, which talks about Psalm 127, about how children are like arrows in the hands of a mighty man. And he wrote a song called As Arrows Do, and it's talking about children being launched, leaving the nest. And I always liked it. I liked the song as a whole, but I especially like that introductory music. It's kind of haunting. So it's not available, to my knowledge. Now, he might make it available. Enough people ask about it that maybe he'll make it available and put it on his Facebook page or something like that. But anyway, that's what it is. John Marr, M-A-R-R. Like I said, last I heard, I think he's still the worship pastor at Calvary Chapel in McMinnville.
Oh, okay. And this wasn't one of my questions, but you said you were talking about your school. What was that?
Well, for 16 years, I ran a school. In 10 of those years, it was in McMinnville, Oregon. Started the school on the Oregon coast. It was called the Great Commission School. It was a 9-month college course, and we went through the whole Bible verse by verse in 9 months with students. So for 16 years, we had 16 different student bodies, and I ran that school. The first 6 years was in Bandon on the coast in Oregon, and the other 10 years were in McMinnville. I closed it down in 99.
Now, the question I called about was, I've been listening to R.C. Sproul for quite some time, and his church apparently is a Reformed church.
That's right.
And I there's a local assembly or group or church, whatever you want to call it, that has started in the Gladstone area here, and I attended, and they recite some things off of a little piece of paper they give you, the Nicene Creed, and when I recited that the first time, I said, "Whoa, I'm not quite sure that I believe what this says exactly." But my question was, what is the Reformed Church? Reformed from what to what?
Well, Reformed theology is the theology of John Calvin, and it arose in the Reformation, which is why it's called Reformed. Luther was a generation earlier than Calvin. And Luther and Calvin both, in their days, were Augustinians. Now, Augustine was, of course, a church father who lived back in the 4th century. And Luther, before he was a Lutheran, was a Roman Catholic, and he was an Augustinian monk. And he taught the views of Augustine, which were later systematized by John Calvin. And because of John Calvin's systematizing of them in his work, which was called the Institutes of the Christian Religion, a generation after Luther, sometimes the views are called Calvinism, but not strictly, because it's probably more often referred to as Reformed theology. When we think of Calvinism, that is part of Reformed theology. That is, Reformed theology includes Calvinism. Calvinism is a summary of Calvin's convictions about salvation and predestination. And he follows very closely Augustine's views on that. Augustine innovated them. They were not found in the church prior to Augustine. So the first 3 or almost 4 centuries of the Christian church, the Augustinian or Calvinist views were not found among Christians. In fact, they were refuted by the church fathers because they were found among the cults. They were found especially in the Manichaeans. And the church fathers all rejected and argued against these views until Augustine. Now, Augustine himself was a Manichaean before he was a Christian. He was a part of the Manichaean religion or cult heresy. And when he became a Christian eventually, later in his life, he formulated these special doctrines of that agreed with Manichaeism, basically, doctrines of divine sovereignty, which was interpreted as meticulous providence, where God, you know, ordains everything that happens, including who's going to be saved and who's not going to be saved. And so the doctrines of predestination, as we know them today, they originated with Augustine. No Christian that we know of had ever taught them previous to him. And Calvin, of course, made them very popular during the Reformation, and thus it's called Reformed theology. Now, those doctrines of salvation, or as they call them, the doctrines of grace, that's only one part of Reformed theology. Reformed theology also has another part which has to do with its overall understanding of God's purpose through the earth, covenant theology, and basically the eschatology. You know the word eschatology?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, eschatology is the doctrine of final things. Reformed theology is going to usually be either amillennial or postmillennial. And in that, they differ from many evangelicals today who are premillennial. But, so Reformed theology has given rise to the Presbyterian denomination. So Presbyterians are Reformed. Also, you know, other regional Reformed churches, like the Dutch Reformed and the Scottish Reformed churches. There's the Christian Reformed denomination. That's what Harold Camping was in, the Christian Reformed, I believe. Although I shouldn't say that, because that makes them seem loony, and they're not loony.
Yeah.
They're not loony. Harold Camping's loony, but I think the Christian Reformed Church, he became an embarrassment to them because he kind of went off the rails. But Christian Reformed, Presbyterian, or sometimes groups just call themselves Reformed, those are going to have Calvinistic doctrines of salvation. And they're going to have either amillennial or postmillennial eschatology. That's what those things would be. What would be called Reformed.
So that's the basis, then.
The basis is really the teachings of Calvin. Although, of course, they would say their basis is the teaching of Scripture. But obviously, that's disputed, since the early Christians for the first three centuries didn't believe that was the teaching of Scripture.
Well, I'm going to have to do a little research about that, obviously. So,
I would suggest getting information from others besides me, including others who are favorable toward the view, because I'm not. That is, I'm not a Calvinist. I am amillennial, so I'm kind of half. I'm Reformed in my eschatology, but not in my what they call soteriology, my doctrines of salvation. I'm not a Calvinist. But if you're interested in what I have to say about it as one part of your research, if you go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, I have a 9-lecture series on this matter where I present the Calvinist doctrines and their defense, and then I critique them and give a defense for what I consider to be a more biblical view. And if you went to thenarrowpath.com and clicked on the link that says topical lectures, there's a series among the topical lectures called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. It's entirely about the Calvinist doctrines. And it's, as I say, some people say from listening to the first lecture they could become a Calvinist because I basically present Calvinism's positive case first in the first lecture.
Uh-huh.
And then I use the other lectures to critique it.
Yeah, it kind of confused me because I went to just a couple of services with this new church, and my concern was the Nicene Creed and how it's worded. And
was it the Nicene Creed or was it the Apostles' Creed?
I believe it was the Nicene Creed.
Okay.
And when I asked about it, they kind of shrugged it off, and I said, "Well, is it just a poorly worded description of what it's trying to say?" And
both the Nicene Creed, and the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed is often recited in church services of all kinds. Both of those creeds are accepted by all branches of Christianity. They're accepted by the Catholic, the Eastern Orthodox, virtually all Protestant groups. So it's not just Reformed theology that would have an agreement with the Nicene Creed. It'd be most groups that don't agree with the Nicene Creed would typically be regarded as heretical or cults, though I'm not sure that's fair to think them that way. But essentially all churches and all groups that are considered to be within the pale of orthodoxy would accept the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed. Now, I will say that there are some lines in those creeds that I might have some reservations about. For example, in the Apostles' Creed, it says that Jesus, when he died, descended into hell. The Bible doesn't say that he descended into hell, and therefore that has raised some questions. People have asked me about that before. The Apostles, or the Nicene Creed, give certain specific definitions of the Trinity which go beyond the wording of Scripture. I personally don't have any serious problem with them. I think my own way of looking at the Trinity is not very different than the way the Nicene Creed would state it. However, the fact that I don't have great disagreement with it doesn't mean that I think it's a good idea to adopt non-biblical language to interpret
things
like
that. The thing that I had a problem with was not that the idea of what it was saying, but it seemed to me that the wording tried to make it sound like Jesus didn't always exist.
They would say he was begotten, not made, from eternity past. But that would mean that he did always exist, as far as they're concerned, and I believe that too. I believe Jesus always existed.
Yeah.
But they say he was eternally begotten from the Father, which just means that. By the way, C.S. Lewis described it in his attempt to do so in his book Beyond Personality, describing the Trinity. He said that Christ has forever been emanating from the Father. In other words, Jesus has his origins in the Father, but there was never a time when the Father existed and Jesus didn't. Just as we might say, if you light a fire, the light and heat that come from the fire, they originate with the fire, but they're no younger than the fire is. As soon as the fire existed, the heat and the light from the fire existed too. So, in other words, if the Father is eternal, as we all believe, then Jesus is eternal too, but he's sourced from the Father.
But the sourcing, see, that's the problem I have with it.
I know. I understand the problem. But like I say, the light from a fire is present as soon as the fire is present. So if a fire had always been burning, then the light from that fire would always have been emanating, because that's simply a feature of the fire itself. Now, I believe it's the Eastern Orthodox who, as their explanation of the Trinity, I found it actually kind of helpful when I heard this. They give the imagery of the sun, our solar sun, in our solar system. That the sun itself is like the Father. The light of the sun is like the Word or the Son, that's Jesus, and the heat is like the Holy Spirit. I may be misrepresenting them. I hope not, but I believe that's how I heard it. And if they don't say it that way, I still kind of like it. The heat and the light have always existed as long as the sun has existed.
Yeah.
In fact, the heat and the light are simply features of the sun itself, but they certainly originate. They originate with the sun. There's no question about that.
That's a good way of putting it. I see that.
Okay.
The other thing, and this is it, when I indicated that I had been listening to R.C. Sproul for some time, they said, well, we don't necessarily really go along with everything R.C. So they didn't say it that way, but
really?
In other words, they have some differences with R.C. Sproul's part of the Reformed Church, apparently.
Well, I can't speak for them. I think I've heard of the church you're talking about before. I think I've talked to people who go there. And I don't want to answer for them, but it's possible that they are Christian Reconstructionists and that R.C. Sproul is not. It's a very strong branch of the Reform movement holds to the view of what they call theonomy and Christian Reconstructionism, which is the view that the Old Testament laws that God gave to Moses, the ones at least that pertain to the governance of a society and the laws, the civil laws for that tell the courts how to administrate justice, that those laws are the best laws ever given to any nation and should be adopted by all nations, including our own. And this has led to some controversy within the Reform movement. But the theonomy means the law of God. Theos is God. Nomos is law. Uh-huh. So theonomos, theonomy, means the law uh-huh. of God. So the theonomists, or the Christian Reconstructionists, they are all Reformed in their theology. But they add something that not all Reformed people hold to, and that is this idea of theonomy, that the laws of the Old Testament need to be adopted by all nations in order to have a just world. And they are post-millennial. Now, R.C. Sproul, he's full-on Reformed, but I don't think he's a theonomist. I can't answer for him because I've listened to a lot of R.C. Sproul, too, in the past, years ago, 15, 20 years ago. I think I had over 100 of his lectures, his tapes, and I've read a few of his books. So I'm not unfamiliar with him, but I think he's gone through some changes in the years. For example, I think he became a preterist in the years since I was listening to him, and he may have become a theonomist, too, but I don't think so. I have not heard so. So my thought is, if they say they don't agree with R.C. about everything, that they might be Christian Reconstructionists, and perhaps he is not. That would be perhaps an area of difference.
It's interesting. I didn't get saved until I was 50, and before that I had no knowledge whatsoever except
what I thought. It must seem that, like there's an awful lot to learn.
Yeah, really. Well, it's been...
The main thing you have to learn
is that I've been a Christian, and I have done a lot of studying, and the more I study, the more I find that there is to study. So
that's true. And of course, the main thing that everyone has to learn is how to trust God and how to love one another. And those are fairly simple, actually childlike traits that have to be learned. But when it comes to theological sophistication, there's a lifetime of study available, which I find exhilarating. Some people say, oh man, there's just too much to learn. I wonder, you know, when people are avid sports fans, they never seem to think that learning all the statistics of all the players of all the teams that interest them is, you know, constitutes too much to learn. It'd be too much for me to learn because I'm not interested. And, you know, if I wasn't interested in God's Word, if I wasn't interested in theology, then I'd consider Christian theology to be, you know, very daunting and very boring. But the fact is, I'm fascinated by it. And I'm glad to spend my life on it.
I've been leading a home group for 13 years, I think now, and we get into what one of the ladies calls rabbit trails, and sometimes I think I see their eyes roll back in their head, and I'm having a great time.
Yeah, not everybody is hungry for knowledge about theological things, and nor do they have to be. You know, that's not necessarily a criticism. It's just I can't understand what would interest them if not that. I mean, if God isn't interesting, if God's ways and God's thoughts are not interesting, what in the world possibly could be interesting?
Exactly. I'll look up your thing on the internet there and go through that. I appreciate that very much. Thanks for letting me on.
Oh, well, it's good talking to you, brother.
All right.
Thanks for your
God
call.
Bless you.
You too. Bye now. Yeah, the lectures he's talking about, for those of you who tuned in, are my lectures on Calvinism. I'm not a Calvinist, but I do analyze Calvinism, its strengths and its weaknesses, in a 9-lecture series, which is free. All our lectures are free at the website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. It's real easy to find these lectures, too. At thenarrowpath.com, there's a tab that says Topical Lectures, and these lectures are topical. They're on the topic of Calvinism. You go there, and there's a whole bunch of sets of lectures, but one of the sets is called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. So that's God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. You can find them there. They're free for download, as all of our lectures are. There's about 900 lectures at our website, all of them free. You couldn't buy something at our website because there's nothing that we will sell you. But there's a lot of free stuff. Let's talk to Trent. Well, before we do, let me give the phone number because we have a line open now. Been talking a long time to our last caller, Jim, and we have some lines open. If you want to call me, the number is 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. Trent's been waiting about a half hour to talk to me, and thank you for waiting, Trent. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. I talked to you maybe Tuesday, and I was asking you some questions about hell, and I ended on, my last question was about divorce and remarriage, and I was wondering if you've taken into account that it could possibly be, Jesus could have been talking about the betrothal period when he says...
Oh, I've certainly considered it. I've certainly encountered that view, yeah.
So
my question is, why would we say that?
That your question is, so now I'm answering your question.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the question that comes to my mind. If someone says, well, when Jesus says you can't divorce your wife except for the cause of fornication, it's not talking about fornication committed during the marriage, it's talking about fornication committed during the betrothal. Well, where would you get that? You know, what is there to indicate that? I know of nothing.
What I've heard is that the gospel that it's in, I think it's, is it Luke?
Well, Matthew is the one that gives the okay. The exception. Luke and Mark don't mention it.
Okay. I've heard that is to the Jews, so that they have a big basis, big importance on the betrothal period.
Sure they did,
so
yeah. Well, it's true. It's true. Matthew was written to a Jewish audience, no question about that. It's also true that they put much more emphasis on the betrothal period than we do. But I don't know that they put more emphasis on the betrothal period than they on marriage itself. And so, in other words, when Jesus is talking about divorce, it's true divorce could be applied to the betrothal period, but why would one limit it to that if Jesus didn't? I mean, people said, they asked Jesus, can a man divorce his wife for every cause? Okay, so the guy's got a wife. That's true that if he's betrothed, he has a wife. The betrothed woman is considered a wife also. But the point is, they didn't say, can a man divorce his betrothed for every cause? They said, can a man divorce his wife for every cause? So they're asking about marriage in general. Now, it's true, they considered betrothal to be about as binding as marriage, so no doubt their question would have to do with marriage and betrothal. Because you're right, the Jews do put a high priority on betrothal. But certainly, to ask a question about divorce generically and about wives generically, there's nothing in the question that would suggest that Jesus' answer should pertain only to betrothal period. And especially because they were alluding to a current debate among the Jewish rabbis at the time. There were two Jewish rabbi leaders a generation before Jesus. One was Shammai, and the other was Hillel. And they were like denominations in the church, but they were denominations of Judaism. The Pharisees mostly followed Shammai, but Hillel's views were very prominent also. And these rabbis had different views about divorce. And there was a raging controversy, at least a long-standing controversy, between the two schools of rabbis, and each had their disciples, and the Pharisees discussed these things. And Shammai taught that you could only divorce your wife if she had been unfaithful sexually. And Hillel taught that you could divorce your wife for just about any reason you wanted to. Now, when they came to Jesus and said, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for every cause? They're asking if Hillel is correct, because that's basically what Hillel taught, and it was a controversy. And Jesus came down on the side of Shammai's view. He said, no, only for the case of fornication. So, but these disputes among the Jews between Shammai and Hillel were not about betrothal. They were about marriage. It's possible that they extended, you know, by extrapolation to betrothal as well. But to say that Jesus' comments only apply to betrothal is to import into the discussion something that was not hinted at.
So if you were, if you had a friend that was asking you about divorce and remarriage, would you feel comfortable giving them direction on that, saying that, well, my wife fornicated. Would you be able to tell them, you know, okay, that's fine. You can be remarried and be divorced. Or would you tell them to go to God about it?
Well, I would never, I can't imagine ever recommending anyone to divorce, even if their wife did fornicate. Now, I'm divorced and remarried, but I never divorced. I got married when I was 19. My wife had several affairs, and I would not divorce her because I don't believe in divorce. I don't believe in divorce. I believe that when you get married, you take vows, and you should keep your vows. And the vow is for better or for worse. However, she divorced me. She left, ran off with someone else, divorced me, and thus I was single again. I remarried because I believe that fornication is grounds for divorce. And if for divorce, then also for remarriage. But I'm afraid that too many people are looking for grounds for divorce. They're kind of looking for a way out of an unhappy
mm-hmm.
marriage. And if somebody is looking for a way out of an unhappy marriage, they may even, almost subconsciously, make it hard on their spouse sexually so that they may be tempted to go out and commit adultery so that the party who's doing the manipulating could feel vindicated in getting out of the marriage. There's just too many people who are thinking about themselves when they think about marriage, instead of thinking about their spouse, their children, and most of all, God. I've suffered divorce twice. My second wife was married to me for 20 years, and then she cheated and left. But the interesting thing is that before she did so, she told a friend, she said she was going to separate from me for a long time so that, as she thought, I would end up, falling to temptation, which I did not. And I'm not sure why she thought I would. I'd always been faithful, and I think she was maybe projecting some of her own issues to me. I'm not sure, but she actually told a friend, "I'm going to leave until he gives me grounds for divorce." So, in other words, she was trying to force my hand into doing something to give her grounds. Well, as it turned out, I didn't, so she divorced me anyway. I was single for 10 years, but I've remarried again. So I've been married, sadly, more times than I think a man should ever be married. But not, I don't believe I've sinned. I don't think I did any sin. I just don't think wives are supposed to leave their husbands and divorce them like that. I think they're supposed to live with them for life. So I never recommend Christians to divorce, even when they have grounds. Now, if someone tells me I did divorce my wife or I did divorce my husband and because of their, perennial straying and fornicating and so forth, then I will not condemn them. Jesus seemed to give that as an option. But just because it's legal doesn't mean it glorifies God. And I'm afraid too many people, they're unhappily married, they almost hope their spouse will give them grounds for divorce. Whereas in my case, my wives did give me grounds for divorce. I wouldn't divorce them. I would still be with my first wife to this day if she had not run off with someone else, even though she was not being a wife. She was being more of a wife to other men than she was to me. But nonetheless, I would have stayed with her. I stayed with her until she was gone and divorced me. So while I believe that there are grounds for divorce, I'm afraid too many Christians are legalistic. They're looking for a legal out to do what they want to do. And I consider that a Christian should never be looking for the option of doing what they want to do, but always what will glorify God most. And when you get married, you swear to God. Usually you swear in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit in a wedding ceremony that you will stay with your spouse till death parts you, for better or for worse, for richer or for poor, in sickness and health. Hey, I believe words mean something. And when you make a vow, you'd better keep it, or else you're lying to God, you're lying to everybody. And liars don't have any place in the New Jerusalem, only in the lake of fire. So I'm saying stay in the marriage if you can. Now, I want to add this. Sometimes a person in a marriage is in danger because of their spouse's violence or other issues.
Yeah.
And I do believe that there are times when a person in danger should take the kids and go to a place of safety. That's not the same thing as divorcing. I believe they should continue to pray for their spouse, continue to court their spouse, continue to seek church intervention to change the spouse. Eventually, it may be that the spouse will divorce them. Maybe the spouse will commit fornication or whatever. They shouldn't hope for that. They should hope for reconciliation. But I don't think that the Christian should divorce, even in those cases. I think they should just go to a place of safety and try to work on reconciliation from that place.
I haven't heard that story, that full story about you yet, and I'm praising God that you're holding to that stand on marriage.
Well, if God hates divorce, how can we not hate it? To me, divorce is the greatest evil that the present church endorses. I don't endorse divorce.
All right. My last thing was when I was asking you about the hell things before, there's a verse in Daniel that says, many who slept in the dust were raised, some to eternal life, some to eternal...
Yeah, Daniel 12:2.
So I was just wondering what you thought about that, and I was just going to let you expound on that and say thank you very much for having me on again.
Okay, Trent, great to hear from you.
Okay.
Thanks for your call. The verse in Daniel is, many that of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. But that sounds like the resurrection. That sounds like the end of the world. And that's what almost all commentators that I know of apply it to. They apply it to the resurrection. There are some problems with applying it that way, it seems to me. Because it doesn't say all who sleep in the dust will arise, and yet Jesus said they will. At his second coming, he said all those who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. Those who've done good to a resurrection of life, those who've done evil to a resurrection of condemnation. So Jesus talks about an hour in which all who are in the graves will come forth, but Daniel doesn't. Daniel says many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. But he only says many of those. He doesn't say all of them. And this raises interesting questions as to whether he's really talking about the resurrection. He certainly is using language like that, but then so do other passages in the Old Testament use language like that. For example, Ezekiel 37 and the prophecy of the dry bones, or 36 and the dry bones, I guess it's 37. The dry bones vision certainly looks like a resurrection. You've got these bones assembling and then flesh coming on them, and they're coming back to life, and then breath comes in them, and they're alive. It certainly describes a resurrection from the dead, but it is explained in the passage to mean not the resurrection at the end of time, but actually it's a symbolic description, in that case, of the restoration of the nation of Israel from Babylon. He said the Jews in Babylon are saying, our bones are dried, there's no hope for us. And he says, no, God can take those dry bones, put them back together in their own land. And he did. He did that. That's how they came back from Babylon. But you see, in Ezekiel, which is a book in some ways very much like Daniel, the imagery of resurrection is used symbolically to mean restoration. Now, it's possible that Daniel uses it that way too. I don't have the time right now today because my minutes are few and my callers are many. To go into all my reasons. But I do have at our website verse-by-verse lectures through all the books, including Daniel. You can download it for free and listen. But listen to my lecture on Daniel 12, and I'll explain to you the other options. I would point out to you that when Jesus was taken as a baby to the temple, and Simeon came and blessed Mary and Joseph, he said in Luke chapter 2, in verse 34, Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, behold, this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel. The word rising in the Greek is resurrection. He's destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel and for a sign which will be spoken against. Now, I don't believe this is talking about the resurrection of the last day. Again, I think the imagery of rising from the dead is used, but I think it's talking about a spiritual restoration of many. And in Daniel 12:2, he says many. Daniel says many of those who sleep in the dust. Simeon says this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel. And therefore, I don't think he's talking about the general resurrection that Jesus talks about. I believe it's talking about the fact that Israel at all times in its history could have been divided into the apostate majority and the faithful remnant, and that what God was doing through Jesus was going to be raising up the faithful remnant and giving them life. As Paul said, we were dead in trespasses and sins, but now we've been raised up with Christ. And the apostate in Israel would be dumped and would come under judgment, as they did shortly after Jesus' death and resurrection. Anyway, those are my thoughts on that. I'm going to have to take some other calls now, but I wish I could give you more right now. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Click on the tab that says Verse by Verse Teaching, and you can select the book of Daniel, select chapter 12, and you'll get the full story here. Our next caller is Carol from Santa Cruz, California. Carol, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is also about divorce, and I thank you for the insight you've already provided. I'm currently separated from my husband. I was single for almost 14 years, and he was single for a long time. His ex-wife of 26 years had an affair and left him and divorced him as well against his wishes. And we were married on June 2011, and then he left me January 11th of this year. And I have been counseled by two pastors in a way that I don't know if it's scriptural, the way they're putting these passages together. I don't know exactly where it is, but in Matthew, you know where it says, if you have something or your brother has something against you, I forget, you go to them. Mm-hmm. You bring two people, as it said in Deuteronomy.
Yep.
And
Matthew 18, verses 15 through 17. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then if he is still unrepentant, he or she, then they're to be, you know, the church is to say that they aren't welcome anymore. Well, the problem I'm finding is, one, I have four men that are supposedly his accountability people. We went to a marriage seminar in October, and there was a man that agreed to keep my husband accountable to a scriptural seminar. I won't say which one. And,
but they're not doing that?
No, and none of these men, none of these four men who agree totally with what he's doing is wrong, will go to him, and the church also will not take a stand. They don't
that
currently
is
very few churches.
An outrage.
Yeah.
That is an outrage. So, and this is only too common. Churches do not confront their members who need to be confronted. They're afraid to. And for that reason, people who don't belong in the church end up staying in the church in compromise and sin, so that the church is basically, Paul said, talking about that very situation, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. He means you allow that kind of stuff to stay in the church, it corrupts the whole church. And sure enough, it has. That's why our churches are corrupt now. The churches do not discipline. And, you know, your husband should come under church discipline. If you've given him no grounds for divorce and he left you, he should be disciplined.
He has a problem with anger, and he said he had a Disneyland idea of what marriage would be. And so we're in a counseling situation, and I'm going to put three conditions and just say, you know, that unless you get accountable to these people and you do what the counselor has said, that we still speak. He will not even talk to me or anything. It's just, he's decided I'm not who he thought I was, and he's out of here, and he went back to live with his mother because he had lost his house to the divorce and everything.
Lovely.
So,
lovely.
Yeah. He's in his 50s, and it's like, besides the fact that the mother is welcoming him there, I would say go home to your wife, you know. But
right.
Anyway, so one of the pastor has counseled me, saying that there is a cause for divorce that is abandonment, that if he is acting as an unbeliever, then I am free to divorce him because he is an unbeliever.
That is true. Paul said that in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 through 15. Paul said, if an unbeliever departs from a believer in a marriage, let him go. And Paul said, the believer is not under bondage in such cases. So you're free. If your husband won't live with you, then he has de facto betrayed his vows. He has essentially divorced you. He may not have initiated a legal divorce, and it would seem to me that you would have the right, if you wished to or if you insisted upon it, you'd have the right to legally solemnize what he has chosen to have without legal, that he has not legalized it. I believe...
to be a Christian, that's the sad part. Anyway.
Yeah, I know it. I know it.
This
guy deceived you. I'm sorry. But there is that also. I mean, fornication is a grounds for divorce, but also if the unbeliever leaves and won't live with you, then they have basically divorced you, whether they've whether they've made that legal or not.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, God bless you, Carol. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday at the same time. And we will continue to do so on all our present stations as long as we can pay for them. We pay a lot of money to be on the air, and we are listener-supported. We have no source of income except our listeners right now, or at any time, really. We don't sell anything, don't have sponsors, don't take commercial breaks. We depend on people like you. If you'd like to see us stay on the air, just write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also find that at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Several lectures have been mentioned on the program. You can find them also at thenarrowpath.com. I'm Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. Until then, may God bless you, and we'll talk again, Lord willing.
When contacting this program, mention you heard it on Central Coast Christian Radio, KKMC, 880 AM. We are talking information.
He was the 16th president of the United States, and most think he was the best. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated at Ford's Theater, telling his wife just before the bullet was fired how he wanted to visit Jerusalem and walk where Jesus walked. Now, Lincoln is making headlines in a new movie by Steven Spielberg, premiering this weekend in Hollywood. It rolls out next week. Starring Daniel Day-Lewis, it's the story of how Lincoln fought for the passage of the amendments giving freedom to slaves. It focuses less on Civil War battles, but more on the battles within the political system. Was he a Christian? Shortly before his death, he wrote a letter in the National Archives saying, "When I received the bitterest blow in my life, the death of my son, I was not a Christian. When I went to Gettysburg, I was not a Christian. But there at Gettysburg, I consecrated my heart to Christ." For more of this story, visit haventoday.org. I'm Charles Morris.
This is Central Coast Christian Radio, KKMC, Gonzales.
Hi, I'm Johnny Erickson Tata with a truly inspiring story. It's about Catherine Wolfe, and oh, what a beautiful woman she is. In fact, after Catherine married and graduated from college, she and her husband Jay moved to Malibu, California, where she pursued a career in modeling and acting. Jay began law school at Pepperdine University, and a couple of years later, Catherine gave birth to their handsome little son, James. But then in April of 2008, when James was 6 months old and Catherine was 26 years old, the unthinkable happened. One afternoon, Catherine collapsed on the floor and was unresponsive. Jay called 911, and when Catherine was admitted to the hospital, it was discovered she had a brainstem stroke, a rupture in her cerebellum. A brave surgeon at UCLA performed an extremely difficult 16-hour-long surgery that no one thought Catherine would even survive. But after 40 days in ICU, multiple surgeries, and months of rehab, Catherine, believe it or not, has resumed an incredibly normal life. Not just a normal life. She resumed a life of hope and joy and trust in God's daily provision in the face of difficulty. Anyone who meets this remarkable young woman is struck by how unself-conscious she seems to be about her paralyzed right side, her slurred speech, and her need to walk with a cane. And it doesn't stop there. Not long ago, while Catherine was home visiting her family in Georgia, she tripped and broke her leg. But with typical fashion, "No worries," she said, even after the doctors put a metal rod inside her leg. "After all," she quipped, "it's already my bad leg." Oh, this incredibly beautiful yet scarred woman was a bright ray of sunshine in that hospital bed. She could have been bitter and bemoaned, "Why me, God?"
she could have been filled with remorse and regret at having lost such a successful modeling career. And you really must go to my radio page at johnnyandfriends.org to see photos of Catherine before her stroke and now after. But every single day, Catherine and her husband, Jay, are pointing others to the Lord all along their journey, a journey that has meant loss of activities like speaking, swallowing easily, seeing, walking, driving, writing, through all these things. This dear couple have viewed every loss as an opportunity to draw closer to Christ. And Catherine has some advice for us all. Not long ago, she wrote on her blog, quote, "What has happened to me is extreme, but it is similar to what everyone deals with. I couldn't walk, but who feels free even when they can? My face is messed up. It's frozen, paralyzed. But who feels beautiful even when they are normal? My stroke makes it hard to eat. But who feels satisfied even when they can eat? My voice is messed up now, but who feels understood even when they can speak? No one. So no matter what the situation, people identify with me and what I am living out. They don't feel free. They don't feel satisfied." But then she adds, "When God is all you have, you realize that God is all you ever needed." Yep, she's one amazing lady, and she and her husband have a ministry called